Okay, fire at will. The bar is open. Ms. Woodruff. Right. Right. Yes, and you're, as far as I can tell, not alone in that confusion. Because I've had other people ask, you know, similar kinds of questions. Again, the what I would call a garden variety malpractice case is one in which a child suffers injury because of a doctor's or manufacturer's negligence. So in the DES cases, for example, a girl is born with the effects of having been exposed to DES while her mother was pregnant with her. If the doctor negligently prescribes it or the drug company negligently distributes it, the child suffers injury and collects damages based on the difference between normal existence and the detriment caused by this drug or the malpractice or what have you. I call that a garden variety malpractice case because it's no different in terms of calculating the damages than the case of Mrs. O'Shea, who gets, you know, injured by the defendant's negligence as she's trying to board this ship. What's different about the wrongful birth and wrongful life cases that makes it not a garden variety case is that the consequence of the defendant's negligence, whether it's medical malpractice or it is a defective product, the consequence is that a child is born who, so to speak, shouldn't have been born. And by putting in those terms, we already sort of alert ourselves to the problem. What kind of a funny thing is that to say? Shouldn't have been born. But that's the nature of the claim. So, for example, I had a case real up to the point of the birth of a child, but there was a real case at Washington State where a woman who lived in the dorms in Washington State was raped by a guy who, first of all, turned out to be, I think he was another student who'd been in and out of the counseling center at Washington State, and secondly, was able to get into the dormitory where she lived and raped her. Now, I added that it was a question about premises liability, about product liability, and about sovereign immunity of the state university. So there are all kinds of other issues going on in the case. I added the question, to be sadistic, I added to the case the further factual development that she becomes pregnant. And so the setup for that would have you say, in effect, when the child is born, it turns out the child has certain kinds of disabilities. I wanted the students to recognize, well, this is a wrongful birth or wrongful life case, because if it hadn't been for the university's negligence in letting this guy run around without disciplining him or warning people about his dangerous propensity, and but for the university's negligence in having these doors that sort of shut and sort of didn't in a dormitory where people are expecting security, but for that, she never would have been raped, and but for that, she never would have had this child with these disabilities. May she bring a wrongful birth claim? May the child bring a wrongful life claim because, again, but for the negligence of these people, I wouldn't have these disabilities. It's Harbison all over again. That's a wrongful birth, wrongful life claim because but for the doctor's but for the defendant's negligence, there would have been no baby. And again, you have all the policy questions. Well, do we want to go there? Most courts, at least in cases of kids with disabilities, say, yes, we do want to go there and award compensation for it. Ms. Stryker. Yes. Now, the one tweak I would do of your summary there is that malpractice may exist in both cases. A garden variety, so to speak, malpractice case, it's still malpractice in Harbison. The doctor failed to do what a reasonably prudent physician would have done. That's why we're nailing the doctor for their conduct. But that's the Chapter 1 issue, so to speak, or as it turns out, the Chapter 10 issues about medical malpractice having to do with defining what is reasonable or what's unreasonable, that's the characterization of the conduct. To distinguish a garden variety medical malpractice case with normal damages, the difference between being born normal and being born with some sort of defect or disability, as distinguished from a wrongful birth, wrongful life claim, which is the difference between being born and not being born. So far, so good? Okay. Mr. Cleveland. Well, you've asked there is no more important question than the one you've asked. Unfortunately, I'm equally hamstrung in being able to answer it, because to answer it would require sort of opening up the whole jurisprudential can of worms here. That is, what is law all about? You know, what do we mean when we say somebody has a right? What do we mean by a right to privacy? What do we mean by a right to life? What do we mean by a right to choose? What do we mean by this, by that? And people are sharply divided on the question of how you identify where do rights come from. Joe Biden and Robert Bork, you know, square off in Bork's confirmation hearing, where Biden tells Bork, you know, the problem with you, Mr. Bork, is that you think the only rights we have are the ones that are found in the Constitution. And Bork answers by saying, oh, Mr. Biden, you think you can make up whatever rights you want, regardless of whether the Constitution speaks to them or not. You know, so you have this kind of, this sharp dichotomy here about, well, what are rights, where do they come from, how do we find their limits, how do they interact with others' asserted purported rights. So, again, extremely important question. What's the relationship between right on the one hand and duty on the other? Now, again, what you see in Dillon versus Legg is the court saying, in effect, rights, schmites, duty, schmooty. In effect, we're gonna navigate our way through the landscape of cases and say, you get to recover, you don't, you get to pay, you don't. When we get done sort of, you know, naming the things we want to recover and not recover, then you can categorize these and say, these people over here owe a duty. These people over here have a right to compensation. Why? Because we say they do. Now, again, that couldn't be further from Cardozo's notion that if law is to mean anything, law means that we sit down sort of in this, you know, metaphysically tidy universe and identify these grand principles upon which we derive, you know, the rights of the governed and et cetera, et cetera. And these different sort of worldviews and different ideas about how it is we approach our job of being judges, being lawyers, being authors of constitutions or of different kinds of legal proclamations, how are we supposed to do that? So, as I say, you couldn't be asking a more important question, but from our standpoint, again, I think you want to have in mind that there is this big debate going on, and we're seeing it played out in particular areas. I want to make sure that for purposes of the exam, not to be too much like the judges in Dillon versus Legg, but to sort of say, when a court says, in effect, these people get to recover and these people don't, my first job as a lawyer is to be able to report accurately to my client. My understanding of the law in most jurisdictions would be that you'd get to recover, or you'd have to pay, or you couldn't recover, you wouldn't have to pay, assuming these other things fell into place and the jury found such and so and whatever. I might, in wearing my other hat of being an officer of the court, a citizen in this great land of ours, a participant in the long-standing constitutional dialogue, I might say, oh, this is crazy, or this is wonderful, but in my function as a lawyer, I'm in the first instance simply, I'm the coal miner, you know, with my little lamp on my head, trying to, you know, navigate our way through this thing and say, it looks like there's a way to get out over there, but this one looks like it's blocked, and I'm less concerned about who designed this coal mine or, you know, who assigned us to this task, et cetera, et cetera. Now, again, that's sort of I think a healthy attitude as a lawyer is able to, manage this sort of tension that on the one hand, I shouldn't be a complete technician. In my function as a lawyer, I should have my mind on larger, I should be able to say to my client, say to a jury, say to a judge with a clear conscience, this is the law and this is the way it should be, and I identify with it. At the same time, I should have some distance from it to be able to say, the fact that the law says this or today the rule is such and so doesn't mean I have to stand up and cheer for it. I can have my doubts, my vigorous disagreement with it, and still learn to live with it. Again, it's sort of like, you know, parenting through your kid through the school system or whatever. Yeah, there are parts of the school I want my kid to believe in, and I don't want to send my kid off to school as though they're going off to, you know, some enemy territory. At the same time, I don't want them to believe everything they hear from the teacher at school is, you know, came down from Mount Sinai. Have some skepticism about what you're getting here. And so again, long answer to your question, but that I think good to think about all those big issues, but also in terms of what we're doing right now, I may be able to solve my client's problem even if I can't solve this bigger theoretical question. I'm still really working on, don't have much of a clue as to how, if I had to answer those big questions, resolve as between Cardozo and the court in Dillon versus Legg to say who had the better of that argument, I'm not sure I could tell you the answer to that. But I can tell you whether you're likely to recover in this case or not. Ms. Shoemaker. Yes. Yes.
I just want to know, in terms of precedent, how do they have to hold the restatement? I mean, do they have to hold something about it?
Good question. It's something I should have mentioned as we were talking about that case, that another reason the court used, they have a list of reasons why they're not going to follow the prior case. They also have sort of considerations, and one of them is, in effect, since the time of that case, at the time the Desitel case was decided, the majority rule was, in effect, don't give a recovery for loss of consortium. By the time Rodriguez was decided, the winds had changed. Now the majority rule was, as reflected in the restatement. So again, the restatement is a kind of a summary. It's sort of as the New York Times would like to think of itself, you know, the paper of record here. You know, if it appears there, that's kind of the the way it is, or Walter Cronkite used it, when that's the way it is, you know, Tuesday, whatever it is. Well, the restatement says this is the way it is. You may like it, you may not like it, but this is kind of the down the middle of the fairway kind of principle. Now, a jurisdiction could certainly say, well, sure, the restatement says this, but our law here in Washington or in Idaho has a different twist to it because, you know, the legislature has said this, or our Constitution says that, or, you know, there's some reason why we do things differently here. So, yeah, we're not in step with the restatement, but that's not fatal. But oftentimes the restatement is a powerful point of reference in a evenly balanced thing to say, oh, well, let's go with the majority here rather than charting our own path in some different way. Just on that point, when we get to Chapter 9 on product liability, the restatement third, as I think I mentioned before, has received vigorous criticism, and many courts, probably more than not, have said, we reject the restatement third. So again, you have you certainly have the freedom, but virtually every time you see the restatement quoted in a court case, they're going to say, and we hereby adopt it. So it has this kind of powerful voice of authority, the voice of kind of the mainstream, if the law is up for grabs, it's got a pretty powerful impact. Ms. Catry. Yes.
Is that more of an exercise in considering what a jurisdiction is saying and using factors to weigh it out, or is it because those factors are so general that they are applicable outside of California?
I think it's the latter, although the former is true to some extent as well. That is, the reason people keep coming back to Dillon versus Legg is because it's sort of identified probably the three most important factors in deciding whether a bystander ought to recover or not. Nonetheless, a jurisdiction can both shade the specific application of the factor to say, well, what do we mean by presence at the scene? Or it may decide how the three factors, whether they are all three have to be present, or two out of three is close enough, or just how it's tweaked. So, again, Hagel versus McMahon is an illustration of the way in which the sort of general problem, using Dillon versus Legg as a kind of exposition of the problem, then can be channeled into a more specific form and adopted. For purposes of the exam, you won't be told you're in this jurisdiction and follows this rule, so you have to kind of speak more generally, and for that reason, Dillon versus Legg, again, is a useful reference point for purposes of the exam, recognizing that it's not like Dillon versus Legg is law, but it's likely that the jurisdiction will follow something like Dillon versus Legg in applying it. And so while I can't say something with certainty, as I illustrated again with the case of the boyfriend who watches his, you know, helps his girlfriend with her mangled hand get to the emergency room and get sewed up, I don't think most jurisdictions would give him a recovery because he does so poorly on a Dillon versus Legg analysis. Mr. Whitfield.
I'm just looking at bystander appearance versus the guarantee of genuineness.
Yeah. Well, I would not use the guarantee of genuineness standard because it's in a bystander case because it's not the one the courts use. The courts use the guarantee of genuineness standard or something like it in those cases where there is no bystander case. It is not a derivative injury. It is a direct injury. So the doctor tells me I have syphilis, and I suffer that direct injury from thinking, oh my God, and it turns out the doctor messed it up, got the wrong lab results or what have you, and was negligent in doing that. The question of whether we say, okay, DeWolf, so he made a mistake, but, where's the bruise? Where's the, no physical injury, go away. Or the court says, wow, this is awful. You shouldn't have to suffer that uncompensated. We're going to make the doctor compensate you for that. The way we decide that case, where it's a direct injury, is through some test like a guarantee of genuineness or some sort of a rule of exception that says most of the time, for most negligently inflicted emotional injuries, we're not going to entertain a claim for compensation. But for this kind of claim, now we're talking. So there's going to be some outlier effect here, call it guarantee of genuineness. I like that label because it's sort of a nice little touch. But you could use other ways of describing this sort of exceptional status that most of the time we wouldn't do it, but in your case we'll make an exception. Again, contrast that with the bystander cases or the loss of consortium cases, which are derivative. There is already a serious injury to someone else, and then we have a bystander or a person in the family connected claiming this loss of consortium, and then the courts have to struggle with, do we say, in effect, every time somebody gets injured, their spouse, their children, their parents, their sisters, their cousins once removed, they all get to line up at the cashier's window and state a claim. Do we have some, way of differentiating, will these spouses get to but not children? Do we have some standard that says only if, how are we going to, and so you will have a more specific set of rules, not about the guarantee of genuineness. You will have a set of rules that say spouses qualify, children don't, or something that's specific to bystander consortium claims. So again, I want to keep them separate based upon whether we're talking about a direct injury or a derivative injury. Ms. Peterson. Yes. We did rush through that. It was.
I'm just trying to figure out the things that we technically should have gotten.
Right.
That case, basically, that the statute of limitations had run out, so wouldn't it have been a wrongful birth? I know, or it's the
Garden Variety. Well, see, did. No. It's not a Garden Variety case. It is a wrongful birth, wrongful life case, but what happens is between the majority and the concurring opinion is, the concurring opinion says it's just a statute of limitations case. And the majority says, well, yeah, the statute of limitations has run, but while we're at it, hear, O Israel, this is what we think, and here's our, statement about what we ought to be doing in these cases. And as I tried to say at the time, I did skip over this, that the reason I stuck that in was that it offers a kind of answer, in effect, to Harbison and to the majority in the Arizona Health Sciences, to the extent that your impulse reading Arizona or reading Harbison was, gee, I don't like this. I don't think courts should be doing this. The majority in Taylor expresses that to the nth degree. And again, the concurring judge says this is out of place. You may hold these opinions, but they don't belong in a case where you've decided it on another ground. So again, it's the takeaway from that is simply more grist for the theoretical mill of do parents have a right to recover for children born with disabilities, or is this something where the rights of the child supersede that of blah, blah, all the big kind of cosmic issues that we waded into. It's also sort of the illustration about, I spent 3 days in Cleveland taking that deposition. I'll be darned if I'm going to get through this trial and never, use one line from that deposition that to the extent that you think, there's got to be something more here, and there are times when you say, no, those 3 days in Cleveland were wasted. As it turns out, I didn't need to do that, and I can't, the fact that I did it doesn't necessarily mean that it has any value. I hope you don't feel that way about Taylor, but you may. So, Yeah, and some, again, you need to be prepared for the fact that some jurisdictions are going to take this flat, you know, as a matter of public policy, we say we're not going to go there. And they have the power to do that. Ms. Jones. I wouldn't put it that way. I'd say the courts are split. There are as many, like Washington, that say this is not an occasion for damages except for the out-of-pocket expenses for childbirth and, you know, lost income during pregnancy, but a very modest kind of award just to sort of pay the out-of-pocket. Beyond that, the kid's yours. Enjoy. As that's one approach. The other is the Arizona case that says, no, that's not a satisfactory answer. These people deserve compensation. How will we do that? Well, we'll set off the debits against the credits. So I would say with a healthy child, they're split. With respect to a child with disabilities, the mainstream says compensate. And again, compensate for the wrongful birth aspects, not necessarily for the wrongful life aspects. More jurisdictions, or at least there are some jurisdictions that say, we'll do the wrongful birth thing, but this wrongful life thing is really distasteful. We don't want to go there. What child would say, gee, you know, I take that back. You could have, suppose in my hypothetical, my Washington State, you know, hypothetical, true case that the student was raped, but hypothetical or fictionalized process that a child resulted from that. Suppose you had a healthy child, physically healthy child, but one who is mad because, you know, I came into this world, you know, my relationship with my mother was ruined because, you know, I was the product of rape and et cetera, et cetera. I had no, my father was in jail, yada, yada, yada. So I don't have physical disabilities like the Harbison kids, but I'm an emotional mess. Could that child claim wrongful life? I don't think the courts would do that because, again, how do you distinguish that situation from other times when, you know, we look at our parents or whatever and we think this just wasn't quite the way it was supposed to be. And at what point do you say this is a life not worth living or this is a life? Again, I view the wrongful life claim in Harbison as not really saying these kids shouldn't have been. I view it as saying these kids, somebody needs to pay for their medical care and their you know, vocational rehab and all this kind of stuff. Well, let's make Park Davis or let's make the Air Force pay for it. So I think in the case of a healthy child, there's no basis in public policy, lots of reasons not to say for a healthy child that a wrongful life claim to say I shouldn't have been born. You know, what's that all about? Whereas with the Harbison kids, you say that so that you can get them compensation, and the courts may buy it. Whether they should or not, it's a different question. Again, going back to the question, I as a technician will advise my client, here are your rights under the law, here as a defendant are the kinds of things you ought to pay for. Whether this is good public policy or bad public policy fits into some larger scheme of jurisprudence with which I'm comfortable. Excuse me, I'm going to defer that question, you know, for another class or, you know, I'll talk about that over drinks with my fellow lawyers. But as I'm counseling my client, I want to keep my eye on what's going to go into their pocket and out of their pocket. Well, it's somebody saying it on their behalf. Of course, all of us, I shouldn't say all of us, but many of us from time to time feel our life is so miserable, we wish we had never been born. Well, I don't know. And see, part of the difficulty is if you have a child, if you have someone, let's say, with Nicole Fortman's level of consciousness, you're trying to state things on their behalf, and you might very well believe that a person in that situation would feel, my life is such a burden to me, I wish I had never been born. Now, speaking very personally, very soapboxy, pardon if this is offensive to anybody, but this is precisely what the Nazis did when they did the, you know, in fact, there's a film that I think it was done on the Learning Channel or Discovery Channel. I think I've got it someplace. I taped it. It's called Selling Murder, and it's the outtakes or the unfinished film productions of the Nazi propaganda folks, and they have a scene of these young medical students, you know, these good-looking Aryan, you know, medical students who are sitting in this class, and the Herr Doktor Professor is explaining to them about the world of medicine and how this is nature's way. See, you have these sheep, and they're the strong sheep and the weak sheep, and you know it's nature's way that the weak sheep die. But you know, we humans haven't quite learned this. You know, we're always trying to save all these people that really nature never wanted them to be saved. And you know, it's our duty is on behalf of mankind to do what nature does and to, you know, take the weak, you know, the runts of the litter and get rid of them. And these, you know, young eager beavers said, "Oh, this is so shocking, doctor. We give a, you know." And the Herr Doktor Professor takes them, you know, well, let me show you, you know, let's go to the mental institution, you know, and here are people flailing around in the mental institution, you know, banging their head against the wall and so forth. And the doctor turns to them, what would you want if you were in their position? If you could speak for them, oh, I would want to be taken out of my misery. That's just what we have in mind, says Herr Doktor Professor. You know, and this is why we take people and we put them in ovens and we, you know. Now, again, at the risk of being horribly offensive here, to the extent that the wrongful life claims are, gee, you know, today no one is suggesting that we ought to take the Harbison kids and, you know, take them out of their misery, but the logic of the judicial sentence, as it were, the judicial judgment is, a wrongful life claim is, these people should not have been born. Their life, and I can understand the parents saying, we as parents didn't buy into this, we wanted, you know, a kid with an IQ of at least this much, this tall, this eye color, you know, we didn't bargain for this, and you might say, well, what kind of parents are you? But you could still say, okay, as to you, if you bargained for this and you didn't get it, all right, we'll talk about compensation for you. But it's different when you make a judicial judgment about the child. And you say, as to this child should not have been born. Their life is more trouble than it is worth to them. The logical conclusion of that, it seems to me, or at least a logical conclusion is, so let's put them out of their misery. Now, you know, I think anybody who does, the justices of the Washington Supreme Court, if confronted with that, would be horrified and offended and would want to slap me across the face and saying, how dare you say this about us? But I'm sorry if I'm on my soapbox here for the moment and you have to put up with it. I find that deeply disturbing. So now I'll go back to trying to be a reasonable guy again. I recognize these are things about which people have very strong feelings, and I don't want you to confuse my sharing my personal opinion with you with the fact that, you know, I teach you about tort law and I want you to become good tort lawyers. I see my job here not to persuade you that my soapbox views on this are right, I feel I have both some right and some obligation to share that with you in the course of what I do, but I would never want to have you feel I have to agree with him, or if I agree with him, I will do better than if I think he's crazy. You're more than welcome to think I'm crazy on the merits of this, as long as you do a good job for your client identifying, here are the areas where you're likely to succeed, here are the areas where you're likely to face trouble. And again, I think spending some time thinking about it is not only important for your long-term happiness in the law, having some reducing the level of cognitive dissonance where this whole thing doesn't make sense. I think it's good for you, for your mental health, if at some level it does make sense, and you got to work at figuring out how it does make sense. But it's also very important to you as a lawyer that you're able to sort of read the temper of the times, that I have a good idea what the judge in front of me may think on these very touchy issues, what the jury may think on these very touchy issues. If it's Nancy Feldman's estate that I'm considering in a courtroom, I have to be very sensitive to the fact that there's Dr. Laura over here and there's Kate Michaelman over there. You know, and I'm trying to think who Dr. Laura's opposite number would be, but there's a very broad spectrum of opinion about the proper, you know, place of women in society and family and so forth. I need to be sensitive to that fact, and I don't know who's going to predominate on the jury. And I shouldn't make assumptions that because my ideas are the right ones, well, of course, the jurors will all think like me, and if I'm a good lawyer, I can persuade them to think like me. I have to recognize that many of them may think very different thoughts, and so what is it that I can offer as a lawyer? One of the things I can offer as a lawyer is just a heads up. If my client believes very strongly that justice is on their side, sometimes I have to say to my client, you know, I wish the law were as you would like it to be, but it may not be, or it isn't. That isn't what this statute gives you. On the other hand, I may have the more enjoyable task of telling my client, you may think you don't deserve a recovery, but the law thinks you do. And you may choose not to exercise that. I'm not telling you have to ask for everything the law entitles you to, but it's my job as a lawyer to at least tell you the law would let you recover this, the law would let your kid recover that, the law would let, you know, these other things. And you may think that that's a stupid way to run the legal system, but hey, I'm just telling you, it's there. In the same way as a doctor, I tell my patient, you can take this drug, you can take that drug. Oh, really? Huh. Percodan? Wow. You know, well, or you may choose not to do that, but it's out there. I don't want to make that decision for you. You make the decision. Donna? The which? Fine. Yeah. Well, to the extent that the distinction, see, when you talk about a suspect class, it's not that a person happens to be a member of that class. It is that the discrimination is made on that basis. So, again, that's the problem in the affirmative action cases, that you are making different decisions. This rule applies to people of this ethnic background. This rule applies to people of a different ethnic background. And you have to be able to say, when we do that, can we meet the test of strict scrutiny? Is there a compelling state interest to justify it? Whereas if it's simply people with an income above this level or people with an income below that level get this treatment or that treatment, you may happen to be a member of one of these suspect classes, but if the discrimination is not on that basis, that gives you no greater rights than anybody else. So the fact that the plaintiff in Fine happened to be a member of a racial minority or a disability minority wouldn't change the outcome. Going once, going twice. See you tomorrow.